Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I have to issue a very sincere every time with the beeping of the phone at the beginning of the podcast. You guys probably think my phone just beeps constantly, but it really doesn't. That's the weirdest bit. What was I saying? Oh, the apology. Yeah, I need to say an apology. Yesterday's episode was very late. In fact, I only posted it a couple of hours ago. I recorded it yesterday. I got it all ready. I even posted the forum for yesterday's discussion. Well, for today's discussion, I suppose. And even posted the link to the episode, but I forgot to hit publish on the page, and then I didn't check my Reddit inbox until tonight, and then I saw that Techrific had been posting, you know, overnight, hey, the episode's not up yet, and then a follow-up one, and so he was on the ball, as Techrific always is, does a fantastic job moderating the subreddit and making sure I don't forget things. But if I don't check my Reddit messages, I suppose it doesn't really work. So that's my bad. I do apologize for that. And thank you, Tech, for doing your part and trying to get onto me, although I was a bit off the grid, I suppose. Anyway, the episode is up there now. If you're listening to this one, you've most likely already listened to it. And you're probably binge listening to two episodes in a row because of their close succession. Anywho, doesn't really matter. Let's continue. And what are we doing today? We're talking about Book 8, Chapter 5, Part 2. And the questions that I asked you guys were these. Do you think Mitya, is murderous, homicidal, or suicidal, or both? And he just cannot stay away from Grushenka. Why is he so obsessed with her? Is it romantic love, or lust, or something else? Techrific said, I'd say old Dmitri could do with a little less passion and a lot more rational thinking. He appears to have come completely unhinged. Is it love that has put him in this state? Lust, passion, a romantic idea of Grushenka? He seems to have projected onto Grushenka his idea of his great love. The question is she really that? She said she only loved him for an hour. Grushenka, in turn, has projected her own idea of love onto the very undeserving Polish character. The pistols suggest suicide or a duel to me. Maybe Mitya himself doesn't know which one it will be. Well, he did say he was going to put one of those bullets through his brain, so I'd say he's definitely at least claiming to be suicidal. Now, yeah, this whole thing about him projecting onto Grushenka seems very much like that, because he's ignoring... Didn't she also hook up with his dad? And that's the basis of their whole feud. And he's kind of saying she's perfect, but in retrospect, I think once his fanaticism, this crazed state of mind that he's in, once it wears off and he starts seeing things clearly, he might realize that, wait a minute, maybe the perfect woman wouldn't string me along and my father along at the same time and have us play each other off each other. Maybe that's a bit of a red flag that she might not be the perfect partner for me. But he doesn't seem to be acknowledging anything along those lines. Somastar says, Grushenka is definitely not what he projects onto her, which kind of gets to the point of question two. He is driven by a fantasy. He imagines a perfect being to him, but this being doesn't exist. He is going mad chasing something that doesn't exist. But I think this is a common folly of man. We perceive something and wind up chasing it, only to find it was never really what we thought it would be. Yeah, story as old as time, right? You ignore someone might be very dismissive of you, but if you really chase them with this lust, you tend to ignore all the signs that they weren't really as interested as you were. Rose-tinted glasses and all that kind of stuff. But he seems to be doing it too an almost impressive degree. His cognitive dissonance is completely shielding him from acknowledging that she's really not what he's imagining. And you kind of feel for her too, because it's not that she's awful. You know, I mean, it's not kind, I suppose, to lead him along. But is she leading him along? Maybe she's being really clear that she's not interested in him. She did say she only loved him for an hour and those kinds of comments. So, yeah, I don't think she's awful. I don't think she's, wife material for someone like Mitcha, but she's just not what he thinks she is. Not that she's completely terrible. She might be completely terrible. I don't really understand her character that well. It's also quite possible that she is just a kind of cruel person, tormenting him in those ways. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, "I'm reading the translation by McAndrews. His translation of the line below really sums up one of my chief exasperations with Dimitri. You treat money as if it was garbage or water." "I am Norwegian," said, "my translation says you treat money as though it grew on trees." I think I prefer the McAndrews one. Isn't that funny how different that translation is? They've gone with a figure of speech which is not a direct translation. It's a it's a approximate translation into more common English phrases. I think the one we read said something along the lines of that first one. You treat money as if it was garbage or water. I remember the water bit. Might have said that. Might have been the same one as Swim said the Mama Fishy. "I am Norwegian," says. "Is he murderous or suicidal? I'm not even convinced that Mitcha knows at this point. He said he'd throw the guns in a ditch on the way. I think he might be oscillating between all three. And he can't stay away from Grishenka. Why is he so obsessed? Is it romantic love, lust, or something else? I'm currently reading The Gambler by Dosto. It is a similar relationship between the main character, Alexei, and Paulina, a female character somewhat similar to Grishenka. Many chapters ago, someone mentioned Apollinaria Soslova. I just noticed that that's where the name Paulina comes from. Lol. A student of Dosto's, 20 years his junior and his mistress. She is widely considered the prototype of many female characters in Dosto's books. She is both Katerina Ivanovna and Grushenka in this book, and Paulina in The Gambler. Anyways, the relationship between the narrator and Paulina is similar. Alexei is hopelessly in love with her, but does not know why. It's not a genuine love, but an obsessive love. He would do anything for her, yet he describes how he often feels compelled to strike, stab, and disfigure her. I think it's the something else option, the kind of love that pulls you to the edges of sanity. Well, that's how it seems, doesn't it? And you've got to ask, was he already at the edge of sanity and happened to fall in love? Or has it driven him there? Because if you're in a good state of mind, healthy, rational person, and you lust over someone, I think you have depending on your age, I suppose, if you're very young, you might not, but I think you have an awareness that, oh, I'm being overthrown by lust, and I'm probably not thinking overly clearly at this moment. You have a vague awareness of it. How much you keep that in check or choose to acknowledge it is, well, it depends really on a lot of things, but I think if you've got a level head, you're at least somewhat aware of the spell that you're under. But here he doesn't seem to be at all aware of it. He's talking about murder and suicide and all these very extreme reactions because he doesn't seem to have that awareness that, oh, wait a minute, maybe I'm just a bit swept away in the moment. No, there is no moment. It's like, this is his life, this is his everything. Anyway, that's the discussion of Chapter 5, Part 2. Now we're going to read all of Chapter 6, which is a 6-page chapter, I think. About 6 pages, yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6.5. Alright, Chapter 6 is called I Am Coming To. But Dmitri Fyodorovich was speeding along the road. It was a little more than 20 versts to Mokroi, but Andrei's three horses galloped, at such a pace that the distance might be covered in an hour and a quarter. The swift motion revived Mitya. The air was fresh and cool. There were big stars shining in the sky. It was the very night, and perhaps the very hour, in which Alyosha fell on the earth and rapturously swore to love it for ever and ever. All was confusion, confusion in Mitch's soul, but although many things were goading his heart, at that moment his whole being was yearning for her, his queen, to whom he was flying to look on her for the last time. One thing I can say for certain, his heart did not waver for one instant. I shall perhaps not be believed when I say that this jealous lover felt not the slightest jealousy of this new arrival, who seemed to have sprung out of the earth. If any other had appeared on the scene, he would have been jealous at once, and would perhaps have stained his fierce hands with blood again. But, as he flew through the night, he felt no envy, no hostility even for the man who had been her first lover. It is true he had not yet seen him. Here there was no room for dispute. It was her right and his. This was her first love, which after 5 years she had forgotten. She had not forgotten. So she had loved him only for those 5 years, and I, how do I come in? What right have I? Step aside, Mitya, and make way. What am I now? Now everything is over apart from the officer. Even if he had not appeared, everything would be over. These words would roughly have expressed his feelings if he had been capable of reasoning, but he could not reason at that moment. His present plan of action had arisen without reasoning. At Fenya's first words, it had sprung from feeling and been adopted in a flash with all its consequences, and yet, in spite of his resolution, there was confusion in his soul, an agonizing confusion. His resolution did not give him peace. There was so much behind that torture. And it seemed strange to him, at moments, to think that he had written his own sentence of death with pen and paper. I punished myself, and the paper was lying there in his pocket, ready. The pistol was loaded. He had already resolved how next morning he would meet the first warm ray of golden-haired Phoebus. And yet he could not be quit of the past, of all that he had left behind, and that tortured him. He felt that, miserably, and the thought of it sank into his heart with despair. There was one moment when he felt an impulse to stop Andre, to jump out of the car, to pull out his loaded pistol and to make an end of everything without waiting for the dawn, but that moment flew by like a spark. The horses galloped on, devouring space, and as he drew near his goal, again the thought of her alone, took more and more complete passion of his soul. More complete possession of his soul, chasing away the fearful images that had been haunting it. Oh, how he longed to look upon her, if only for a moment, if only from a distance. She's now with him, he thought. Now I shall see what she looks like with him, her first love. And that's all I want. Never had this woman, who was such a fateful influence in his life, aroused such love in his breast. Such new and unknown feeling, surprising even to himself, a feeling tender to devoutness, to self-effacement before her. I will efface myself, he said, in a rush of almost hysterical ecstasy. They had been galloping nearly an hour. Mitya was silent, and though Andre was, as a rule, a talkative peasant, he did not utter a word either. He seemed afraid to talk. He only whipped up smartly his three lean but mettlesome bay horses. Suddenly Mitya cried out in horrible anxiety, Andre, what if they are asleep? This thought fell upon him like a blow. It had not occurred to him before. It may be that they're gone to bed by now, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. Mitya frowned as though in pain. Yes, indeed, he was rushing there with such feelings. While they were asleep. She was asleep, perhaps, there too. An angry feeling surged up in his heart. Drive on, Andre, whip them up, look alive, he cried, beside himself. But maybe they're not in bed, Andre went on, after a pause. Timofey said there were a lot of them there. At the station? Not at the posting station, but at Plastunov's, at the inn, where they let out horses, too. I know. So you say there are a lot of them. How's that? Who are they? Cried Mitcher, greatly dismayed at this unexpected news. Well, Timothy was saying they're all gentlefolk. Two from our town, who they are I can't say, and there are two others, strangers maybe, more besides. I didn't ask particularly. They've set to playing cards, so Timothy said. Cards? So maybe they're not in bed if they're at cards. It's most likely not even, not more than 11. Quicker, Andre, quicker, Mitcher cried again, nervously. May I ask you something, sir? Said Andre after a pause. Only I'm afraid of angering you, sir. What is it? Why, Fenya threw herself at your feet just now and begged you not to harm her mistress. And someone else, too. So you see, sir, I'm taking you there. Forgive me, sir. It's my conscience. Maybe it's stupid of me to speak of it. Mitcher suddenly seized him by the shoulders from behind. Are you a driver? He asked frantically. Yes, sir. Then you know that one has to make way. What would you say to a driver who wouldn't make way for anyone, but would just drive on and crush people? No, a driver mustn't run over people. One can't run over a man. One can't spoil people's lives. And if you have spoilt a life, punish yourself. If only you've spoiled, if only you've ruined anyone's life, punish yourself and go away. These phrases burst from Mitcher almost hysterically. Though Andre was surprised at him, he kept up the conversation. That's right, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, you're quite right. One mustn't crush or torment a man, or any kind of creature, for every creature is created by God. Take a horse, for instance. For some folks, even among us drivers, drive anyhow. Nothing will restrain them. They just force it along. To hell, Mitcher interrupted and went off into his abrupt, short laugh. Andre, simple soul, he seized him by the shoulders again. Tell me, will Dmitri Fyodorovitch Karamazov go to hell or not? What do you think? I don't know, darling. It depends on you, for you are, you see, sir, when the Son of God was nailed on the cross and died, he went straight down to hell from the cross and set free all sinners that were in agony. And the devil groaned because he thought that he would get no more sinners in hell. And God said to him then, don't groan, for you shall have all the mighty of the earth, the rulers, the chief judges and the rich men, and shall be filled up as you have been in all the ages till I come again. Those were his very words. A peasant legend, capital, whip up the left, Andre. So you see, sir, who it is hell's for, said Andre, whipping up the left horse. But you're like a little child, and that's how we look on you. And though you're hasty-tempered, sir, yet God will forgive you for your kind heart. And you, do you forgive me, Andre? What should I forgive you for, sir? You've never done me any harm. No, for everyone. You, here alone, on the road, will you forgive me for everyone? Speak, simple peasant heart. Oh, sir, I feel afraid of driving you. Your talk is so strange. But Mitcher did not hear. He was frantically praying and muttering to himself. Lord, receive me with all my lawlessness, and do not condemn me. Let me pass by thy judgment. Do not condemn me, for I have condemned myself. Do not condemn me, for I love thee, O Lord. I am a wretch, but I love thee. If thou sendest me to hell, I shall love thee there, and from there I shall cry out that I love thee for ever and ever. But let me love to the end, here and now for just 5 hours, till the first light of thy day. For I love the queen of my soul. I love her, and I cannot help loving her. Thou seest my whole heart. I shall gallop up. I shall fall before her and say, you are right to pass on and leave me. Farewell, and forgive your victim. Never fret yourself about me. Mokroi said, cried Andre, pointing ahead with his whip. Through the pale darkness of the night loomed a solid black mass of buildings, flung down, as it were, in the vast plain. The village of Mokroi numbered 2,000 inhabitants, but at that hour all were asleep, and only here and there a few lights still twinkled. Drive on, Andre. I come, Mitcher exclaimed feverishly. They're not asleep, said Andre again, pointing with his whip to the Plastunov's Inn, which was at the entrance to the village. The 6 windows looked on the street were all brightly lit up. They're not asleep, Mitcher repeated joyously. Quicker, Andre, gallop, drive me up with a dash. Set the bells ringing. Let all know I have come. I am coming. I am coming too. Andre lashed his exhausted team into a gallop, drove with a dash, and pulled up his steaming, panting horses at the high flight of steps. Mitya jumped out of his cart just as the innkeeper, on his way to bed, peeped out from the steps, curious to see who had arrived. Trifon Borossovich, is that you? The innkeeper bent down, looked intently, ran down the steps, and rushed up to the guest with obsequious delight. Dmitri Fyodorovich, your honour, do I see you again? Trifon Borossovich was a thick-set, healthy peasant of middle height, with a rather fat face. His expression was severe and uncompromising, especially with the peasants of Mokroi. Excuse me. But he had the power of assuming the most obsequious countenance when he had an inkling that it was to his interest. He dressed in Russian style, with a shirt buttoning down on one side and a full-skirted coat. He had saved a good sum of money, but was forever dreaming of improving his position. More than half the peasants were in his clutches. Everyone in the neighbourhood was in debt to him. From the neighbouring landowners he bought and rented lands which were worked by the peasants, in payment of debts which they could never shake off. He was a widower, with four grown-up daughters. One of them was already a widow, and lived in the inn with her two children, his grandchildren, and worked for him like a charwoman. Another of his daughters were married to a petty official, and in one of the rooms of the inn, on the wall, could be seen among the family photographs a miniature photograph of his official, of this official, in uniform, and official epaulettes. The two younger daughters used to wear fashionable blue or green dresses, fitting tight at the back, and with trains a yard long, on church holidays or when they went to pay visits. But next morning they would get up at dawn, as usual, sweep out the rooms with a birch broom, empty the slops, and clean up after lodgers. In spite of the thousands of rubles he had saved, Trifon Borossovich was very fond of emptying the pockets of a drunken guest, and remembering that not a month ago he had in 24 hours made 200, if not 300, rubles out of Dmitri, when he had come on his escapade with Grushenka. He met him now with eager welcome, scenting his prey the moment Mitya drove up to the steps. Dmitri Fyodorovich, dear sir, we see you once more. Stay, Trifon Borossovich, began Mitya. First and foremost, where is she? Agrafena Alexandrovna, the innkeeper understood at once, looking sharply into Mitya's face. She's here too. With whom? With whom? Some strangers. One is an official gentleman, a Pole, to judge from his speech. He sent the horses for her from here, and there's another with him, a friend of his, or a fellow traveller. There's no telling. They are dressed like civilians. Well, are they feasting? Have they money? Poor sort of a feast. Nothing to boast of, Dmitri Fyodorovich. Nothing to boast of, and who are the others? They're two gentlemen from the town. They've come back from Cherny, and are putting up here. One's quite a young gentleman, a relative of Mr. Musov. He must be, but I've forgotten his name, and I expect you know the other, too, a gentleman called Maximov. He's been on a pilgrimage, so he says, to the monastery in the town. He's travelling with his young relation of Mr. Musov. Is that all? Stay, listen, Trifon Borossovich, tell me the chief thing. What of her? How is she? Oh, she's only just come. She's sitting with them. Is she cheerful? Is she laughing? No, I think she's not laughing much. She's sitting quite dull. She's combing the young gentleman's hair. The Pole? The officer? He's not young, and he's not an officer either. Not him, sir. It's the young gentleman that Mr. Musov's relation. I've forgotten his name. Kalganov? That's it, Kalganov. All right, I'll see for myself. Are they playing cards? They have been playing, but they've left off. They've been drinking tea. The official gentleman asked for liqueurs. Stay, Trifon Borossovich, stay, my good soul. I'll see for myself. No, now answer one more question. Are the gypsies here? You can't have the gypsies now, Dmitri Fyodorovich. The authorities have sent them away. But we've Jews that play the cymbals and the fiddle in the village, so one might send for them. They'd come. Send for them. Certainly, send for them, cried Mitya. And you can get the girls together as you did then, Maya especially. Stepanida 2, and Arena, 200 rubles for a chorus. Oh, for a sum like that, I can get all the village together, though by now they're asleep. Are the peasants here worth such kindness, Dmitri Fyodorovitch? Or the girls either, to spend a sum like that on such coarseness and rudeness? What's the good of giving a peasant a cigar to smoke? The stinking ruffian, and the girls are all lousy. Besides, I'll get my daughters up for nothing, let alone a sum like that. They've only just gone to bed. I'll give them a kick and set them singing for you. You gave the peasants champagne to drink the other day, ich. For all his pretended compassion for Mitya, Trifon Borisovitch had hidden half a dozen bottles of champagne on that last occasion and had picked up a 100-ruble note under the table and had it remained in his clutches. Trifon Borisovitch, I sent more than 1,000 flying last time I was here, do you remember? You did send it flying, I may well remember. You must have left 3,000 behind you. Well, I've come to do the same again, do you see? And he pulled out his roll of notes and held them up before the innkeeper's nose. Now, listen and remember. In an hour's time, the wine will arrive. Savouries, pies, and sweets, bring them all up at once. That box Andre has got is to be brought up at once, too. Open it and hand champagne immediately. And the girls, we must have the girls, Maya especially. He turned to the cart and pulled out the box of pistols. Here, Andre, let's settle. Here's 15 rubles for the drive and 50 for the vodka. For your readiness, for your love, remember Karamazov. I am afraid, sir, said Andre. Give me 5 rubles extra, but more I won't take. Trifon Borisovitch, bear witness, forgive my foolish words. What are you afraid of? Asked Mitya, scanning him. Well, go to the devil, if that's it, he cried, flinging him 5 rubles. Now, Trifon Borisovitch, take me up quietly and let me first get a look at them, so that they don't see me. Where are they? In the blue room? Trifon Borisovitch looked apprehensively at Mitya, but at once obediently did his bidding. Leading him into the passage, he went himself into the first large room, adjoining that in which the visitors were sitting, and took the light away. Then he stealthily led Mitya in and put him in a corner in the dark, whence he could freely watch the company without being seen. But Mitya did not look long, and indeed he could not see them. He saw her, his heart throbbed violently, and all was dark before his eyes. She was sitting sideways to the table in a low chair, and beside her, on the sofa, was the pretty youth, Kalganov. She was holding his hand and seemed to be laughing, while he seemed vexed, and not looking at her, was saying something in a loud voice to Maximov, who sat the other side of the table, facing Grushenka. Maximov was laughing violently at something. On the sofa sat he, and on a chair by the sofa there was another stranger. The one on the sofa was lolling backwards, smoking a pipe, and Mitya had an impression of a stoutish, broad-faced, short little man, who was apparently angry about something. His friends, the other stranger, struck Mitya as extraordinarily tall, but he could make out nothing more. He caught his breath. He could not bear it for a minute. He put the pistol case on a chest, and with a throbbing heart he walked, feeling cold all over, straight into the blue room to face the company. "Aye," shrieked Grushenka, the first to notice him. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. A good chapter. It's so strange. Like, the writing is so smooth in this chapter. And the last chapter, too, was very smooth. Very readable. I just find that so weird. There's such a stark contrast between the quality of the prose from one chapter to the next. Which kind of, to me, is an indicator of poor quality, funnily enough, because it's so inconsistent. So, yeah, if the whole book was written in language as clear as this, not that it was super clear, but it was readably clear, and I found it easy to follow, if the whole book was like that, I'd have no problem getting through it. You know, nothing in this chapter felt overly like it went over my head or anything like that. Such a strange thing. Maybe it's me. Maybe I was just not paying attention during those difficult chapters. I don't know. Strange. Anyway, I enjoyed reading that chapter. It was quite good. Thanks for listening. Head over to the Reddit, have a bit of a chit-chat, and I'll see you tomorrow.